winds up to 30 miles per hour. Current stats, wind west at 11. Sunshine, some clouds out there. 38 degrees, Racine, 37 in Kenosha, wind chill plus 3. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This Saturday evening, February 1st, the Racine Theater Guild welcomes to its stage best-selling author Michael Perry, Wisconsin's own. I've had the great pleasure of interviewing Michael Perry on 5 different occasions, and we're going to share with you today excerpts from 3 of those interviews, beginning with a conversation from back in 2012 when we talked about his book, Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. At one point in this new book, Visiting Tom, you write, "We live on a farm, but I am not a farmer."
Well, the reason for that, and I get into it in a little more detail in the book, but obviously for means of promotion, which is part of this business, I'm often touted as this writer slash farmer, and I always think of the farmers who raised me. I think of my brother, who right now, as we speak, you know, is looking at his cornfields in the middle of this drought and wondering about next year. And here I am. I'm a guy who, there's no getting around it, I make my living by writing and performing, and I have a little patch of corn and a little patch of oats, and I have some pigs sometimes and some chickens. But if I come home from book tour and my pigs are all dead, that's a bad weekend. But if my brother loses all his corn, you know, then he actually put his whole deal on the line there. So yeah, I'm always careful not to overdo the farmer thing too much.
Right.
But I really do. I mean, I still bale hay with my neighbor, and you know, we do some stuff, a little bit of farm work, put up our own firewood, that kind of stuff.
But you say if you are absent from the operation upwards of 100 days per annum, you dare not designate yourself a farmer.
No. Plus, when I go down to the feed mill to get feed, all they would have to do is ask to look at the palms of my hands, and the discussion would be over pretty quickly. I have the hands of a typist, not a farmer.
Actually, one of the moments in this book that I really deeply appreciate, and I want to just touch briefly on this, and let's explore it in more detail a little bit later. But the framework of the book is your encounters with this neighbor of yours, Tom Hartwig. And each chapter of the book begins with a vignette, something about him or about his particular farm or something about his life. And I especially love how you open up the second chapter of the book talking about Tom Hartwig's very crowded workshop. I mean, which is just loaded wall to wall and floor to ceiling with all kinds of stuff, and I mean, it's an amazing amount of equipment, machinery, and tools, and so on that fill up this shed, and I so love the way you appreciate this and what it represents in a way that sails right over the heads of most of us city slickers. If you'll permit me to read one paragraph, and then I'd love you to kind of expound on it a little bit. You write at the end of this long, interesting description of this workshop, "For now, though, you backtrack through the maze and simply run your eyes around the place. You wonder what calculus might quantify the cumulative toil represented by every hand-worn tool, every besmudged Folgers can brimmed with bolts, every belt and pulley, every project set aside for the moment how many years ago. And this is only what is visible and tangible. What of every project in and out of here over the decades, right through today? Somewhere right this instant, a hand-turned axle bears the weight of a loaded hay wagon. A refurbished bushing vibrates in the bowels of a $250,000 combine. The weld bead on a corn picker slowly rusts in the blackberry canes out behind some barn somewhere. In stillness, the place echoes with work. I mean, a lot of us would look at that and just see a kind of a dirty, junky-looking shed, and you see, in a sense, an amazing monument to work, and particularly the work that has been done by this neighbor of yours.
Yeah, I think a couple of things come to mind, and one is you mentioned city slickers, and that's one thing I'm always careful about, because sometimes I feel like there's this false dichotomy thrown up that, you know, I'm the country mouse explaining things to the city mouse, and I always try to be careful of that, because the city mouse has a lot to teach the country mouse too. And I'm thinking in particular of a lot of my friends in more urban settings who are finding, you know, and I write about a guy actually later in the book who's living in a suburban setting but raising quite literally tons of food in his backyard and that kind of thing. But there is something about the cumulative work and looking around that place, and I get into it a little more in depth in the book, that I was raised around folks like Tom, and naturally that's part of what drew me to write about him, is some sense of preservation or trying to cheat time a little bit. But you do see all this accumulation, and it is, perception is funny. I love to study that stuff and write the paragraph that you just kindly read, and of course it takes me forever, and 57 drafts, and I'm trying, how can I keep this interesting even if I'm just talking about a messy shop? And it's, perception is funny, because I love the poetry of all those words that, you know, aren't ones I thought of, but just the words that describe a shop or talking about a particular type of tool, and so that's all fun. But then where I'm getting to here with the idea of perception is, I lovingly craft this description of Tom's shop, and at one point I went over the description with Tom, and he said, you know, I talked about the accumulation of toil and the echo of labor, and he said, oh, to me it just looks like I'm going to wind up on one of them hoarder shows. So he's much less romantic about it, but and you know what? I'm not sure I can articulate this well. I do much better typing with lots of revision. I'm not so hot on the fly, but I'm a guy, it's been a long-term source of some humor, but also genuine embarrassment, that I'm a blue-collar guy with farmer, logger, trucker roots. Those are the folks who raised me, and I can speak the language, and I can walk like them and talk like them, and I'm very comfortable now at the feed mill. But the truth is, I could no more tear apart and put back together successfully an engine than I could be a ballerina. And I lack very basic mechanical skills, and I wouldn't be a good full-time farmer. And yet, because of where I was raised and because I do like to write, I do have this ability to immerse myself in that world and then try to convey it to folks who might not be familiar with it. And I always feel a little bit of redemption there, where, you know, perhaps I can convey to another group just why a dark, dingy, cluttered shop like that is so meaningful to some of us. I don't know. I hope.
We're speaking with Michael Perry, and we are talking about his latest book called Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. This is probably as good a time as any for you to kind of explain how this book came into being. And it's kind of interesting dual stories that sort of form the, I don't know, kind of the spine of the book itself. Was this an idea entirely of your own making, and did anything in particular sort of create that light bulb above your head that this story of your life and your neighbors would be a wonderful vehicle for yet another great book?
Well, the parts of the book that look like it was well thought out and planned, they just happened. So there, you know, there's a parallel story, which I'll get into in a minute. That was completely not on the radar when I started. But initially, I mean, my first thing is that I make no bones about the fact that I've got two little girls and we're a self-employed family, and so I'm trying to make a living. So I'm always looking for, you know, what can I write about that I think will attract some interest. But then it has to interest me, and it has to be something I care about. And the first time I went to meet Tom and his wife, it was as a guest of my eventually to-be wife. And I have the scene in the book about the first time I stepped into their kitchen, and I was swept by such a feeling of comfort and recognition. I'd never met these people, but I knew exactly where I was and how to comport myself. And so and then Tom is just one of those, I think I've variously described him. In one case, I described him as a roughneck polymath. He's just one of those guys that he can do everything. And he's not just, this is not just him doing foxfire tricks. And, you know, he talks in there about how to make oxen yokes. And he talks about driving his team of oxen. But this is a guy who also will talk to you about the latest automotive technology. I mean, he is up to date on current events as well. And I thought it would be wonderful to try and accurately portray him. And so then once I had that idea, the other thing that I wanted to avoid was I didn't want this to turn into one of those Tom is my mentor, I'm his acolyte, I study at his feet, and, you know, he makes cannons and shoots them. And for a little while I thought, you know, I should do a book where he and I will build a cannon together. And perhaps that would be a better book and maybe it would sell more copies. But I just realized there would be an artifice to that I really couldn't get around. And so the ultimate point of the book is, what can you learn from a guy who's simply your neighbor? And we have a little bit of a personal connection because my wife grew up in this area and she used to work for Tom. But in general, he's just my neighbor. We're not best buddies. We don't see each other a lot. I generally go over there when I need something cut, bent, or welded. And sometimes you go over for dinner and take a dozen eggs or some of our pork chops. But I really just wanted to write a book about what you can learn in passing from someone. And in his case, as it turns out, quite a lot. And then the other part of the story is that he lived on a very secluded farm all of his life. He's been there 82 years. And until middle age, it was very secluded. You couldn't really see any other roads, no one else, and he had a creek running through his barnyard. And then in the mid-60s, the U.S. government put an interstate, literally aimed it at his barn, took it right through his yard. And in the book I write about, he was able to get him to move it enough so they didn't knock his barn over, but that was the only battle he won. And so he now, this guy, went from living his entire life in this quiet, isolated farmstead with a creek gurgling just down from the barn to now he has over 8 million vehicles a year going through his front yard, over 20,000 a day. And I'm fascinated by how he can go on a wonderful rant about the whole thing, quite entertaining. But he's also got equanimity. He's lived a full and happy life. He hasn't let this monstrous intrusion distract him from being engaged. And so that was, as I began to get into the book deeper, I realized that's what I was really shooting for here, is exploring that idea of equanimity. And then, of course, I write in there that as I'm working on the book, we live at the top of a dead-end road that's on a very steep hill, and for 100 years people have been making the hill by getting a run at it, as we say around here. And the local highway commissioner decided to redesign the intersection based on what he termed safety improvements, and I submitted that his safety improvements would actually make it so we couldn't get up our hill and create more hazards. And in a nutshell, he and I disagreed. We continue to disagree, but I write about how we handled that in the book, and that my little mini quandary with this tiny little intersection, you know, we're talking 30 feet of blacktop and gravel here, as compared to Tom's 8 million vehicles a year, it became kind of this comic backdrop to the much larger battle that Tom had to fight.
You mentioned the fact that you first met Tom and Arlene Hartwig through your wife. They were already friends of hers, and you talked about this what you call in the book this gut level sense of comfort that you felt the moment you crossed the threshold of their home. I mean, it's like it was home in this amazing way. But you go on to talk about something else about that night when you met the Hartwigs for the first time. This was not only about meeting them and liking them so much, but this was also about learning something or about your wife or seeing something about her very clearly for the very first time. Talk about that part of this special night.
Well, when I walked through the door with her, I went into this kitchen that was, you know, it's not all shiny and spit polished, and there are some dishes stacked, and there's a ice cream bucket full of, well, now you would call it compost, but in my day we just called it food garbage. And you know, there's stuff, magazines and books and flyers and junk mail stacked around, and there's a dog on the floor and a gigantic cat in the chair. And but what I meant about the comfort is you walk into a kitchen like that and you realize that you don't have to take your boots off. You don't have to call ahead so that they've got quick time to clean it up. They're just interested in seeing you and visiting. And so that was the, you know, the worn floor that you could wear your boots on. And so there was that immediate physical comfort and recognition of these were the kitchens I walked into when I was, when my dad would take me and I would be sitting there on his knee. But then as we talked and I got to know them, and they reminded me even more of the people I grew up with, and the fact that they're just hardworking, quiet people. The fact that my wife had chosen to take me to meet these people and hadn't taken me there right away. She had waited until she knew me a little bit and had made it clear that these people meant a lot to her. When I realized that these were the kind of people she valued, that I remember that night, something clicked in me where I went, well, if she values these kind of people, that tells me a lot about her. And I think that's probably the pivot that you're referring to.
I sure am. You write, as I watched her laugh and trade stories, I saw signs of an old soul, a person who paid her respects and paid them to the sort of people much of the world passes by at top speed. Prior to our night in the Hartwig's kitchen, I saw Annalise as beautiful, desirable, smart, and strong, more than enough, in other words, and easily more than I had earned. But as I watched how she honored Tom and Arlene with nothing fancier than honest talk and clear laughter, I began to realize I had found a person perfectly and unpretentiously matched to the roughneck kitchen of my dreams.
Pretty much.
Well, and I love the point you're making there, because I think a lot of us don't stop to think about that, that one of the ways we get to know each other and really get a sense of the character of each other is the way people treat other people and the people that a given person values and wants in their life and appreciates. I mean, I'm not sure there's anything that says more about us and what is important to us than what people are important to us.
Yeah, I won't elaborate, because I think that little section said exactly what I mean. I would only add, I've just then spent the rest of our relationship trying to continue to earn her attention.
Michael Perry wrote the book Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace, published in 2012 by HarperCollins. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we are hailing the work of Michael Perry in anticipation of his appearance at the Racine Theater Guild this Saturday evening at 7:30. Next is an excerpt from his delightful book, Coop, A Year of Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting, published back in 2009. In writing about your life with your wife, Annalise, and your daughter, Amy, there is also the matter of eventually the entrance of a new daughter, your daughter, Jane. And among the many interesting things you talk about in this experience is of the interesting difference of opinion that you and your wife have when it comes to something like medical care. And I think you say something to the effect that if there's anything that can be kind of an uncomfortable rub between the two of you, it is over this issue. Just talk about it for a moment, if you would.
Well, it's funny, because I wrote in Truck that one of the things we did that I scoffed at, and then after we did it, I thought it was tremendously valuable, is premarital counseling. And we did it with a minister, and at the time I thought it was kind of fluffy, and then once I went through it, I realized it was just terrific. And we started with a strong base, and I'm happy to say that that has continued, and we seem to be of one mind on most things, and on those things that we are not, we knew about it going in. The one thing that I didn't anticipate and that we have had to deal with is that we have divergent opinions when it comes to issues of health and medical care. And my wife, just to sum it up without getting too long and specific, is that my wife is much more open and actively involved in alternative medicine and healthcare, and I, of course, come from a more Western medicine background, and I have a nursing degree. And although I'm very open to alternatives, I tend to be skeptical and a little bit grumpy when they get brought up. And so it is something that we struggle with. There are some areas, especially when it comes to the children, that we have to sit down and hash it out and then make a decision, and then you decide you're going to back your partner. It's also, I think, I get a little bit of a chuckle out of it just because it was so unanticipated.
Hmm.
You know, they tell you to make sure you're of one mind about finances and all of these things that can undo a marriage, and all that's been going great, but here came this issue of health care, and who would have thunk it?
So
my wife is a woman of great independence and strength. She's also more educated than I am, so I frequently battle at a disadvantage.
So in this particular case, when she gives birth to your new daughter Jane, it is at home,
yes,
and with the assistance of a midwife. I mean, something we don't hear all that much about anymore.
Yes, we moved into this old farmhouse in the middle of the country, up on a windy old hill in the dead of winter, and my wife was several months pregnant, and she announced that she wanted to have the baby at home, and so we started to go see a midwife, and I, as I write in the book, I had my doubts there too, but I also write about how I came to eventually feel that it was acceptable, and not only that, something I was interested in trying. But my initial reaction, I think I wrote in the book, is she said, "I'd like to have the baby at home," and I said, "Ha ha ha!" I gave this very nervous laugh, and then her gaze hardened, and I realized, no, she's pretty serious, and I've got to make an appointment with the midwife. Ultimately, it was just a terrific experience, and we were surrounded by people we loved and cared for, and I felt safe. And the thing that helped me a lot is I was very frank about my concerns, and we put things in place to address those concerns, and I never felt that we were in over our heads.
Tell our listeners about the presence, albeit in a whole different room, I think, maybe even a different building, of a friend of yours named Mills.
Yes, well, some of your listeners may be familiar with the term doula, and my best definition of a doula is that it's a person, usually a woman, who is present with the mother during the birth process. She is available to the mother for all of her needs, spiritual, material, physical. And what happened is, as we were working our way through this process and preparing for the home birth, I started to take attendance. And there was my wife, there was my daughter, there was the midwife's assistant, the midwife's apprentice, my wife's mom, my mom, my wife's best friend, and I said, you know, it's running about 8-1, girls against boys here. And so I told my wife, I want to have a doula. And she said, oh, that's fine. Who do you have in mind? I said, my buddy Mills. And if you've read Population 485 or Truck, you've met Mills before, and you know that our friendship is predicated basically on shooting carp with bow and arrow. And so I called him and said I wanted him to be my doula, and of course I had to explain to him exactly what that entailed. And part of it was in fun, but part of it was very serious. He and I met 20 years ago working as young EMTs, and he has since gone on to be a paramedic, and he's actually delivered 6 babies in the field. So I told him, Mills, I want you to come and be my doula. And I said, now, you can't really be in the room. That made my wife pretty uncomfortable, but I want you on the place just in case something goes wrong. And so, yeah, he actually... My doula showed up in Crocs, camel pants, a greasy ball cap, and he had a big old Big Gulp mug and a bunch of newspapers under one arm. And while we had the baby in the house, he sat in the garage and read his newspapers and drank his Big Gulp mug. But I joke about it, because thankfully we did not have to use him. And there is a certain amount of humor to it, and it's exactly as I report. But it truly was reassuring to me to have my roughneck friend just a few feet away across the yard, knowing that he could help me out if I needed him.
And I love the exchange which occurs between the two of you once little Jane has been born and everything is fine, and you come find him where he's reading, and you say everything's 10-2, old-school emergency radio code. 10-2 means everyone's safe and everything's okay. You say if Mills had grinned any bigger, he'd have sprained his ears. He stood up, grabbed my hand, and shook it good. He walked to the house with me, climbs the stairs, says a quick, gentle hello to Annalise, peeks at the baby, and takes his leave. At the top of the stairs, he stops. Need anything? Nope, I say, and away he goes. Among the bedrock gifts of time are friendships expressible in 5 syllables or less. I imagine you can point to that quite a lot in your life.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I should even elaborate. I'm much better in edited and in print than I am mumbling on the phone. But yes, I can think of a handful of friends where really the locked gaze is enough and the words are extraneous. And I just remember that moment with such clarity and realizing you live all your life in an attempt to accumulate a handful of friends like that, where just a word or two says everything that you need said.
You write so beautifully about parenting, the way that you were parented and the way now that you are parenting Amy and Jane. One of my favorite stories from your childhood is of what was absent from your home, things like television. I don't remember if radio was absent as well. There was a phonograph, and with permission, you were permitted to play some of the LPs that were on the shelf. Although you tell us a story about how your mother, in effect, censored one of the LPs on that shelf for one band of that LP. Would you tell our listeners about that?
Yes, I hope I can remember the name of the song. We had a collection, I believe it was a collection of old railroad songs. And on there was a song called Bill Grogan's Goat, if I'm getting the title right. And somewhere in, it's about a goat that eats somebody's laundry, and so they tie it to the railroad track. And there's some sort of pun payoff joke about what happens to the goat when the train comes. And there's either the use of the word H-E double toothpicks, as they say, or there's some punning reference to it. Whatever it was, my mother deemed it inappropriate, and she took a needle and went from the gap, the little gap that was on old LPs between the preceding song, gouged a diagonal line right through to the gap that started the next song, so that whenever you played that album, it would finish the song, it would come to Bill Grogan's Goat, you'd hear this thunderous, scratching rumble as the needle whipped on to the next track, and then the following song would start. And what I love about my mom is that, as I put in the piece, if you accused her of censorship, she would have looked you right in the eye and said, exactly.
I love that. You you write about your own style, and maybe there's just a touch of an echo of the firm hand with firm yet loving hand with which your parents raised you. You say, I believe it benefits the child to know who the grown-ups are. Heavy on the mister, my dad used to say.
Well, I have to be careful now when I start sloshing around parental advice, because I'm an absent-minded knucklehead myself, and I don't pretend to be speaking from any position of privileged authority. But there are a few things. Like, I've always said that, of course, I love children. I've got two girls that just absolutely carry my heart in their tiny little hands. But I also believe that you don't do them any favors by not giving them some sense of reality and priority. And I've always said that, I think in one of my books I might have written, I'm not sure if I wrote this or just remember it, but I said something to the effect that people are always saying, if only we would be more like the children, the world would be a better place. And I always say, well, my answer to that is lock 3 kids in a room with 2 toys and then you understand why the world is exactly as it is, because we do act like children. So I think there's a danger in just telling them constantly that they're wonderful, pure little beings. And I think there's what I was getting at with that mister thing is there was just this sense when I grew up, whether it was the farmer down the road or whether it was the lady that my mom and dad bought the farm from and she would come out and make lefse and cook, there was this idea that I suppose the cliche would be respect for your elders, but there was also just this idea that as children, we weren't running the show. We were encouraged to be an active part of it. We were loved and welcomed, but the adults were in charge. And I think there's certain amount of comfort in that as a child, too. It's not about squashing the child or quelling what they want to do, but it's about just, it comes back to that whole safety thing, I think.
Hmm.
Plus, as I tell my daughter, if you want to sit in front of the wood stove of a cold winter's morning, you can come out and stack some firewood. That's the way it works.
One of the things that is a very harsh reality in the pages of this book is death. And death comes to your lives sometimes in the experience of having several of your chickens killed by a dog. It is about the reality of slaughtering livestock. And then, of course, much, much more significant and painful is when death visits you at one point in the death of a friend, at one point.
Your frustration that this is new. We've been saying this, the Congolese people.
Nephews. One of the things you say about this experience is that when this young nephew of yours died, there was no poetry in it. I think I know exactly what you mean, but could you talk a moment about that?
I think I was trying there to convey some respect to my brother and my sister-in-law, because I had a contract with a publisher to write a book about a year in my life. And of course, I had no way of knowing that right in the middle of that year, they would lose their son. And it was an integral part of the story, so there was no pretending that it didn't happen. I had to write about it in some way. But the truth is, of course, I was just sick about it, and I wish it never happened. And so where I'm trying to say there's no poetry in it is that nothing I can write can fix that, can repair it, and I didn't want anyone to get the impression that I thought otherwise. In this case, I'm afraid I am simply reporting. And so I hope that's what I conveyed with that line.
Hmm. I think
I don't think of myself as a, you know, I would not assign myself this higher purpose of being able to somehow provide comfort in the wake of something that horrible, and I just wanted to make that clear.
Hmm. One of the things, as you do share about that experience, is how powerful it is to see grief as it plays out in various mourners, and so many of those who come to mourn the tragic death of this youngster come at it with in their own sort of rough-hewn way. And you said it struck me again and again how much we miss if we rely wholly on poets to parse the tender center of the human heart. At times like this, I am grateful I was not raised to be sleek. Speaks a little to what you were just saying, I think.
I hope so, yeah. It's just, I'm thinking right now of this, not only the people who showed up, but the people who are still showing up at my brother's house. And for the most part, they are roughnecks. And they're not there to give him hugs or talk him through anything. They're just there to be present and to help out. And, yeah, I think anything more I would say would just be me going on and on. But there's just some very simple, basic beauty to the goodness of people.
Hmm. Michael Perry is the author of Coop, A Year of Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting, published back in 2009 by HarperCollins. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and we are hailing the wonderful writing of Michael Perry today in anticipation of his appearance this Saturday evening at 7:30 on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild. And we're actually going to finish up with an excerpt from my first interview, my earliest interview with Michael Perry from 2006, talking about his wonderful memoir, Truck, A Love Story. Speaking of contradictions, here's an interesting image you create for American culture. You say the world of American culture and commerce functions like a combination of sponge and sandpaper, absorbing everything and smoothing it down so it slides easily into a designer shopping bag. That's a really thought-provoking picture you paint there.
Well, I think I was writing about, I'd been thinking about the fact that NASCAR, you now see NASCAR references in New Yorker cartoons. You can also buy a yoga mat at Walmart, and it's one of the terrifying beauties of this country and capitalism and free market economy, and that some beautiful things happen and some really disturbing things happen, and in the middle, just plain weird things happen. We have a way of commercializing everything.
I would really feel...
See those NASCAR guys, you know, man, I'm a dirt track stock car guy. I still go to the local dirt track stock car races where it's my neighbors, and they should probably be spending their money on other things than their latest demolition derby car. when I see these NASCAR folks, man, they've gotten, you know, they're all polished up, and they're coming at you straight from Madison Avenue now.
There are so many other things we could talk about in your book, including the guns you own or the recipes you cook or more about your courtship. But I think I would feel most remiss if we didn't touch at least for a minute or two on a figure by the name of Ozzy, who I think is such a poignant, powerful figure in your book. Tell our listeners really quickly who Ozzy is and how your paths crossed.
I used to work on one of my last jobs as a registered nurse was on a rehabilitation unit. Took care of folks that had high-level spinal cord injuries. I left the hospital and moved up to northern Wisconsin. I was working as a writer, but I got a call one day. There's this Ozzy lives out in the country near me, and he's got a very high-level injury. He's a ventilator-dependent quadriplegic. He needs 24-hour-a-day nursing care, and he asked if I could come and help him out now and then. And so I agreed, although I told him ahead of time, I said, man, I haven't worked in a hospital for a long time. I'm out of practice. And he said, oh, you'll be fine. Well, then later I find out that his definition of nurse is really pretty loose, and several of his nurses were bikers, and I'd sometimes be called in on short notice to cover for them when they couldn't make bail, that sort of thing. But Ozzy, what I love about Ozzy, we sometimes tend, when people have a severe life-changing injury, we tend to assign angelic qualities to them. Ozzy was a gearhead, motorhead, knucklehead before he ever got hurt, and he remains one. Now, what I admire about him is he's in complete charge of his care. He directs his care, and that's kind of a hospital term, but it's critical. He doesn't sit around and wait for someone to help him. He tells you what he needs, and he understands the limitations and extents to which he must, under which he must function, but he just presses on. He was a gearhead. He had this old 68 Charger he bought in 1984, long before he was injured, and he started fixing it up, and that was his dream to get it running. And just within the last 2 months, he went for his first ride in it. The thing's beautiful now. He's got big racing slicks on it, and he just keeps moving forward. He is not looking for anybody's pity. He's not happy about what happened to himself, but he sees that he's in this position, and he's just going to move forward. And I always promised Ozzy that when I got my old truck running again, I'd come over and we'd put up the ramp and run his wheelchair up in the back, and I'd take him for a ride one day. And I'm happy to report that in the book I note that I still hadn't managed to pull it off, but I'm happy to report that 2 days before I left on book tour, my brother and I took the old 1951 International over to Ozzy's place. We put the ramp in the back, and we wheeled him up in there and strapped his chair down, and we took him down the road in the back of the 51 International.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He came to my reading the day that I kicked off the book tour, and I read a little bit about Ozzy, and I'm going to tell you I didn't make it all the way through. The guy's he's an inspiration to me, and I don't mean that in the poster sense.
Right.
An inspiration to me on a day-to-day basis.
Well, and you really help us understand what someone loses when they are placed in that sort of position, either by calamitous injury or by terrible illness. One of the things which he, for instance, has lost is the ability to yell in a moment of anger or a moment of fear. That is one thing, because of his dependence on a ventilator, that in a sense is taken away from him.
Yeah, you've got the obvious. I mean, he can't move. He can't scratch his own nose. But one day, I wasn't just joking about some of the rough characters he hangs around. And one day I was sitting with him at his house, and this guy showed up, and he was whacked on meth, and it was an acquaintance, and the guy was threatening, and he was going to hurt us and all this stuff, and he yelled at us for about 5-10 minutes, and then he just all of a sudden left, and I was terrified. The guy was real scary, and we didn't know what he was packing, but I marveled at the fact that the whole time Ozzy kept talking to him very calmly, and it wasn't until later that I realized that Ozzy can't raise his voice. He has to speak when and how the ventilator allows him, which is he's interrupted constantly when the ventilator takes a breath, and also he has only so much breath to use, so his voice stays the same volume. And so then I asked him about that, and he said, yeah, one of the great frustrations, he says, is I can't yell at people when I'm angry. I can't express myself the way I want to.
And you tell the story of when you have, in the past, done work to fix an obstruction from his trachea tube. You might be at the trash thing, and then you realize you hear a clicking sound behind you, and it is Ozzy just clicking his tongue to let you know that you've forgotten to reattach his ventilator tube. You say he can't scream, he can't grab you by the neck, he can't stick a boot in your terminally forgetful blankety-blank the way he ought to. He just has to patiently click.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, and he just, he does it because that's the position he's in, and yeah, he teaches you that one right away when you first start working with him. Hmm. If you forget to hook his ventilator tube up, he clicks his teeth together.
Hmm.
You feel a little bit stupid. You should.
Right.
He's a good guy. The other thing I love about him, and again, I said we tend to assign qualities to folks who've suffered injuries that are sometimes a little bit demeaning, and one of the things I love about him is he doesn't feel sorry for himself. And one day he called me, that phone rings, and it's him, and he's using his voice-activated equipment. And he said, man, I just had to call you to tell you that I just got a certificate from the local aerobics club. He said, it's good for 12 free hours of aerobics. He says, I want to know when you're going to get me down there because I'm going to go claim them.
Hmm.
Yeah, so he's a funny guy.
Heroism comes in a lot of different forms, doesn't it?
Yep. Mm.
As I finish this book, I have absolutely no sense that you are ever holding back. I mean, it just seems like a wonderfully honest, vibrant, colorful account of yourself, your life, and the lives of so many people that you know and work with and have befriended in your small community in Wisconsin. But in fact, are there people in your life whom you had to, in effect, sort of bypass, or interesting stories that did not or could not find their way into the pages of your book because of a respect for people's right to privacy and that sort of thing? Tell us how you handled that.
Well, there are a couple of issues that come to mind, and the first is a fundamental one, at least when I was writing a book like Population 485, where I was talking about ambulance calls and specific medical information. I have a nursing license in the state of Wisconsin. I also at that time had an EMT license. I'm now licensed as a medical first responder. And that meant that I had certain extra legal restrictions on me if I was writing about medical information. And so in those cases, I would not only change a name, but I would change some identifying characteristics. But in other cases, I try to approach it case by case. I write, I hope, very honestly about myself and about the people around me. I'm not in the business of blowing the lid off anybody's personal life, so I suppose there's some selection that goes on there. But a lot of times I just take the straightforward approach of asking the person I'm writing about. There's a character in Population 485. He's a one-eyed butcher. We call him Bob the One-Eyed Beagle. He has one eye, one kidney, and two ex-wives, both of whom work at the only gas station in town. And I write very specifically not only about the way he looks, but about his failed marriages and some of his other shortcomings. And what I did in that case is when the book was in its final version and it was the last chance to change anything, I had him over to my house and we sat down at my table and I went through paragraph by paragraph what I had written, and I made it clear to him ahead of time that I wasn't going to change facts and I wasn't going to embellish anything and I wasn't going to make his eye all better or fix his marriages, certainly. But I wanted him to at least to know what I'd written, and what I told him is if I got any facts wrong, he should let me know. And also if he thought there was anything that was just gratuitous and hurtful. He's a pretty rough character, but when I would read each paragraph to him and then I'd say, well, what do you think of that? The answer he gave me, I can't say on the air. but it was in the affirmative, which meant it was okay to go, and he basically said, I don't give a bleep. And in other cases, on a more serious note, in the first chapter of Population 485, I write about the death of a young girl, and in that case, her mom is a janitor at the local school, and I remember the night I sat down to write about that and realized that was going to become chapter one, and I walked over to the school and found her sweeping in the halls and told her I wanted to write about her daughter and asked how she felt about that, and she gave me the go-ahead. There's no legal standing to that, but as far as living with my neighbors, it's the course I like to take. And I think ultimately, I mean, I did insist that the editors let me write honestly about my where I live and the folks that I live with. I don't want to turn it into some idyllic little town. It's not as a complicated place as all places are. But I do also try to maintain some level of respect there because these are the people that raised me. These are the people that I'm grateful to be their neighbor. So I try to maintain some sort of rough respect and also take a few shots at myself, which is a pretty big target.
That's part of what makes the book work, of course. How conscious do you think are your neighbors and colleagues and buddies that you are a writer and that anything that you are experiencing together is potential fodder for the present or a future book? I mean, you know what I mean? It's kind of the same way as, I mean, the people that are on these supposedly reality shows, slice of real life kind of TV programs, but who know there's a TV camera sort of perched over their shoulder. It seems like in those cases it has to make a difference. Does it in your case, or have you found ways to keep everybody just living realistic, authentic lives?
It varies. I mean, the one thing that's nice in my case is that I have control over what I'm going to write. So if I feel that somebody's acting for me, then it's just not going to go in the book. But in general, the answer to your question is both yes and no. The yes part is that, for instance, after I finished writing Population 485, and this Bob the One-Eyed Beagle had become quite a character in the book, and he was always making these really pithy comments that were bizarre and funny and weird all at once, and I included several of those in the book. Well, after the book came out, he started making some sort of weird comment on every single call that we made, and frankly, the quality really went in the toilet. They just weren't that funny, and he not only would he make these comments, but he'd quick look to see if I had jotted it down, which is kind of funny because I don't jot things down in front of people on a daily basis. And I finally just told him, I said, Bob, I'm done with the book. You can relax. but on the other hand, one of the reasons I treasure living where I do and being a member of the local volunteer fire department and hanging out at the chicken barbecue is that I'm still a neighbor and I'm a member of the fire department. And when I show up to a barn fire, or if we have a medical call out in the country in some trailer house, they give a rip that I'm a writer or that I might be observing. They want me to function in the present and perform my duties as a member of the volunteer fire department.
And so do you.
Yeah, I just I absolutely treasure the fact that I was raised in a rural area with blue collar folks, and I still work beside them. I just happen to be typing in my house. so I don't, yes and no. Certainly, I do get the comment every once in a while, oh, I bet that's going in the next book, and sometimes it is, you know.
Mm.
But the good news is, boy, I don't have to solicit material. They cranking it out all the time.
Michael Perry's book, Truck, A Love Story, was published by HarperCollins back in 2006. And more information about this and other books by Michael Perry, as well as other aspects of his career, can be found at his wonderful website, sneezingcow.com. Michael Perry is appearing on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild this Saturday evening, February 1st, 7:30 p.m. For ticket information, you can go to racinetheater.org or call the box office at 262-633-4218. And tomorrow and Friday on the morning show, we will be taking a look at the proposed natural gas power plant in the town of Paris with Con tomorrow and Pro on Friday, if you will. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today is going to be a sunny, windy, and mild day with a high of 43 degrees. Clear overnight with a low of 28. Sunny tomorrow and very mild. Tomorrow's high, 55. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.